Hello and welcome to Resource Report, where we share with you important information about local nonprofits and resource organizations that support the community we share, produced by Pathways to Agency. I am your host, Rainmaker. Today's show features memory activist Elaine Vredenburg of Window Seat Media. Here's Elaine. I am here at Window Seat Media upstairs at the Arbutus Folk School building with Elaine Vredenburg of Window Seat Media. How are you doing, Elaine?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
So what is your position here with Window Seat Media and how did you come to be here?
Yeah, good question. Well, I am the memory activist here at Window Seat, and that's essentially maybe a fancy word for oral historian. And I've been with Window Seat since the beginning. I'm actually the founder of the organization and the co-director. So I have, I work with one other person, Meg Rosenberg, who we're co-directors together here at Window Seat. And my role really has been around stewarding and facilitating our community-based oral history projects. So Meg Rosenberg and I are co-directors at Window Seat. Mm-hmm. Meg came on, I think, in September of 2021, I want to say. And part of the reason we were excited about collaborating and Meg coming on was because they had this idea of starting a theater company. And at the time, we thought, oh, what if we run that theater company through Window Seat? So Brave Practice was a playback theater program of Window Seat. And playback theater is a form of improvisational theater where people share real stories from their life and then actors play them back on the spot on stage. And it's been a storytelling format that I've always really appreciated. We did a lot of partnering with the Heart Sparkle Players, which is also a playback theater, before Meg came on, and integrating playback as part of like a way that we can activate stories in the community has always been exciting to me. So Meg came on and, you know, brought this theater company idea, got, you know, a group of actors together. And we ran Brave Practice, I think, for 2 or 3 years, at least 2, maybe close to 3. And it was great. Meg did a variety of workshops, like where people actually got to learn the improvisational skills. We utilized it a lot as, you know, integrated into the activation phase of our projects, where we got to do theater performances as an event to like share stories from our projects. That was really great. And then it just sort of naturally came to an end, you know, just shifting priorities. And Meg has been really excited about shifting into a new role in the organization that really utilizes their public administration background. So taking on, you know, in the coming months, hopefully taking on more of the, yeah, just more of the administrative end of our work, budgeting and fundraising and these kinds of things that we need to focus on really to keep afloat.
Oh, yeah. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So Window Seat, I guess to back up a little bit, Window Seat is a community oral history and storytelling organization. We've been partnering with the community, I would say, since 2017. That was our first community-based project. And basically, we are really interested in, I would say, sort of partnering with communities to document and amplify stories that we don't always hear in our community. So partnering with organizations, with underrepresented communities and individuals. And all of our work is a very community-based process. So instead of me as an oral historian going out and interviewing 100 people, we like to convene cohorts of community members who would like to learn oral history, interviewing, editing, transcription, public programming, all of those things that go into curating a sort of public history project. So people come together, we have cohorts, and they learn all these different skills. Over the course of maybe it's a year, maybe it's 2 years, it sort of depends on the project. So they learn those skills and then we present stories in the community.
That sounds fabulous. What kinds of stories do you present about the community?
Yeah, great question. Our projects generally tend to be thematic since the beginning, and we've done a wide variety of projects. Let me think about some of them. Window Seat started really by doing a lot of partnering with organizations that are really interested in farmland stewardship, working lands, farmland preservation. So our work really began around that theme. We partnered with the Community Farmland Trust and the Thurston Conservation District and did a variety of primarily video projects with those communities. So I'd say that was a big theme that we worked on for a while. We also did a theme around death and dying, actually, just thinking about what are our stories around death and dying, where do they come from, and how do they impact the care we seek and receive. That was a really big project that we did that was very community-driven. We had a whole working group that came together around that project. We did a series of audio stories. We had a variety of really dynamic, multifaceted community events. We did one event at the Lord Mansion that was an all-day event with various kinds of workshops and sort of non-traditional, I guess I would say like sort of progressive approaches to end of life. So things like green burial and home funerals, death doulas, all the things kind of maybe take place outside of larger institutional settings. Sharing that knowledge and just getting folks in the community to realize, wow, there are these other resources, these other ways of doing things at end of life. So we had all these workshops happening, and we always have an arts component. So there was like a pop-up exhibit, and we had a visual artist who had their work on display. We had a playback theater performance. So we had all these ways that you can engage both in like the learning around those resources as well as kind of the storytelling around those resources. Around that kind of a project. So Inhale Exhale was a really big project we did. We also, through that project, engaged with a whole group of sort of younger artists in town, and they put on a big event at the Capitol Theater, and there was a dance performance that they put together. We had a lot of different visual art in the theater. We showed some short films. It's pretty amazing. So we did that whole series called Inhale Exhale. And then what else? Let's see.
You had the Third 30, the Voices from the Tidelands, Voices from the Harbor.
Yeah, we have so many different projects. Yeah, so the Third 30 was a project that we did in partnership with Senior Services. That's where it started anyway. Mm. We approached Senior Services. They had a lifelong learning program. And we said, hey, could we do like a workshop series with you? Around oral history interviewing, where elders could interview other elders who took the class. And that's where that project really came about. And so it was an 8-week program that people could sign up for. And they interviewed somebody that they admired in the community. And then I taught them how to take that interview from a transcript to a short written narrative. And then we would have these really sweet little gatherings where they would read the stories aloud. And share kind of what they learned through that process. So that was really a sweet.
That sounds cool. Yeah. What was Voices from the Harbor about?
Yeah. So Window Seat at the time, Voices from the Harbor was our very first public program and public storytelling project we did. And it happened to be a collaboration with the Evergreen State College. I was teaching at the time in the harbor, in Grays Harbor County. Evergreen had a program out there actually serving the harbor students. And one of the faculty at Evergreen, Stephen Buxbaum, and I collaborated, and we wrote a grant that was administered through Evergreen to do a series of events in Grays Harbor County that was utilizing oral history interviews that students had been conducting, because Stephen had been working with students around oral history interviewing and documentation of the Grays Harbor community for a while. They had published a short book of stories from an oral history collection that the students had gathered. And so we wanted to take this wonderful source material that the students had produced and bring those to life in the community in interesting ways. So we created we did a event at one of their historic theaters where we recorded some of the stories. We recorded actors reading the stories, and we grouped them together by themes of migrations, belonging, mentors, neighbors, and allies. And we played those themes in this wonderful theater. And so you got to listen to the stories, and we had some sort of facilitated conversation after that. So we were able to share those stories out. We also had a community mapping project where we used those stories as like sites on the map, and then people could add their own stories and their own sites on the map. So we did a community mapping project. And then finally, we did a community conversation on housing and homelessness, which is a big issue on the harbor and intersects with a lot of the stories. So yeah, that was that series.
That sounds really fabulous. What was the turnout for that?
You know, the Grace Harbor community is a community that I noticed that's really invested in its history. We had a really well engaged community for all of those events that we did. It was really kind of exciting, and it was pretty intergenerational too.
Mm-hmm. What's the, is that like, would you say that that was a larger turnout than they usually do, or what is your usually turnout for your events?
Yeah,
with collaborating
question.
With this,
it sort of varies. I think some of our best attended events have been the Inhale Exhale series. Both of those events at the Capitol Theater and at the Lord Mansion were both really well attended. I would say that Window Seat does smaller events very well, and I think the nature of our work is really around connecting together through our stories, and so creating spaces where people feel safe to share personal things about their lives. So oftentimes that works the best in a smaller setting. So I think for us, we love events that are like 45, 50 people. A bigger event might be 90 people. But I think maintaining that sort of intimacy feels like an important piece for us.
Yeah, for sure.
Having more informal, smaller events.
And I noticed something on your website talking about ethical storytelling. Can you talk about that, what that is?
Yeah. So we feel really committed to being stewards of other people's stories. So this idea that we don't own anybody else's story, basically it's on loan to us for as long as people would like it to be. We take the role of steward really seriously. So, because we know that these kinds of fields of oral history, sociology, anthropology, all these kinds of fields that work with sort of quote unquote human subjects, come from a history of exploitation and extraction, often going into communities and taking stories for whatever purpose the researcher might want them for. And often not to benefit the communities themselves. So we have like a long legacy of that within academia and within public settings as well. And so I think our fields feel really committed to righting those wrongs and moving forward in a way that feels really collaborative and reciprocal. And so what that means for us is ongoing consent with our narrators. So like I said, you know, they own their stories themselves. They're a part of the whole process. So, when we complete an interview, it's important to go back to the narrator, share the recording, share the transcript, give them an opportunity to make any edits they might want, you know, make sure everything is transcribed accurately, like names of people and places and things like that. But most importantly, then how they're represented. So obviously, you know, we often will take a transcript and then edit it down into maybe like a 3-minute story, or maybe there's an excerpt on an exhibit display somewhere. So we want to make sure that whatever way we're presenting somebody's story, that they're comfortable with that. So we'll go back and say, hey, here's what we produced with your story. What do you think? You know, before it's published, for the public, we make sure that they sign off and say, sounds great. Or actually I'd like this, you know, this changed in it. And we have had moments where people have said, you know what, I'm going to withdraw from the project because I, you know, decided I don't want to participate in this anymore. And so I think that's okay too. You know, it's really up to them. And we just appreciate the relationship. So we really try and be as relational as possible. And we make mistakes just like anybody else, but we just are working towards that end of being relational, reciprocal. We've all had an experience to varying degrees where, you know, maybe it's a photograph somebody took of you and put on a website somewhere and you like really hate the way you look, or like, you know, I mean, it's important to feel like you have agency in how you're being presented to the public, you know.
Absolutely.
So whether it's a journalist or, you know, an organization that's snapping a picture of a program that you're participating in, it's always important to get people's feedback. And it does take extra time. You know, it's easier to have somebody sign a release form and never see them again, you know. Like, it's easier to do that, to just know, oh, I have their photo release, it's fine. But it's just like, again, it's like, well, this is a person that you have a relationship with. And sometimes, you know, taking the time to go back and saying, hey, we're going to put this on the website, what do you think? You know, it's just a nice little move to take.
Absolutely. I like appreciate that very much. Yeah.
And I think the idea of ongoing consent is that, that, you know, you might have an intention with a story, say, you know, we're doing a project and we know we're going to produce an exhibit. So we ask permission and, you know, we get the sign off from folks and the exhibit goes up. And then maybe a year later we say, oh, well, this is a great story. We want to do X with it. Well, it's important to go back to the person and say, hey, we have this new way we might want to use your story. Is that okay? You know, just knowing that people's relationships to their stories change over time and they might like forget that it's even there and decide, oh, you know, actually, I don't want that up there anymore. You know, so it's important to sort of circle back with people. And I think on the flip side of that, you know, again, if you think about it as a relationship, it's an opportunity to like check in with that person and see what they're up to and just sort of revisit that relationship with them too.
So. Absolutely. I mean, it can happen that they think of a new detail to mm-hmm. that story that mm-hmm. they forgot to tell you the first time. And it might be like a game changer for mm-hmm. the direction that might take.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one good example, you don't always know the kind of impact that errors can make, too. So one example that I give is that I was working on this project. This is sort of a precursor to Window Seat. It was one of the pilots that I did before we founded Window Seat. And I was working with a bunch of gooey duck farmers. And I had put together an exhibit that was going to be in Seattle at the Folklife Festival. And I shared the panel with one of our farmers, and gooey ducks are grown sometimes in these PVC pipes that are put in the beaches, and they have to be a certain size, like the whatever the I don't know what the permitting or whatever it might be called requires that they're a certain size. And I got the size wrong on the exhibit panel. It was just like a typo, I think. And she picked it up and she said, oh, you need to change this because we would get in a lot of trouble if it was published and they found out that we were growing gooey ducks in the size of PVC pipe that was too small. And it wasn't that they were actually growing them in too small PVC pipes. It was just that I made like a typo on the panel. And so it's like an example. It would have never crossed my mind, but they could have actually gotten in a lot of trouble.
That's really important.
Yeah. So you don't know, like you could have the best intentions. And even if it's a small typo, there could be something in there that you just don't know about. So
for sure. Yeah. What is the impact that you look for with your work?
A couple of things come to mind. One of the biggest things that we're interested in is expanding the archive. So, for example, right now we're doing a Pride storytelling project, which is about documenting local LGBTQ history here in Thurston County. There's a lot of history. And a lot of it kind of lives in people's, like the physical items, like the archival items, like newspapers and different things, live in people's like attics and or personal homes. There's not a whole lot in physical archives or in the library, and there's not a lot of interview content. And so we convened a cohort of queer storytellers, essentially, to do that documentation work. So they're just finishing their first year of doing interviews, and they interviewed 18 people in the community, which is great. Next year, we'll have a year of public programming, so we get to share out some of those stories. But I would say, you know, having that documentation effort so that it's accessible, we're partnering with the Timberland Regional Library. So we'll have some of those stories and materials available for future researchers to be able to check out at the library. So that feels like an impact that we're hoping to make, is just creating more primary source materials that are accessible around particular histories that we are less documented in town that are important. You know, there's been a lot of contributions from the LGBTQ community here in town, and we want to share and celebrate those. So that's, I guess, one impact that is a goal of ours. We also, with that project in particular, this idea of bringing people together across generation feels really important. So we had an event on June 3rd where we got to celebrate that first year of research, and it was a pretty intergenerational group. We had somebody who was probably late elementary school who shared a story, all the way up to somebody in their 70s or, you know, maybe close to 80s. So it feels really good to have people from different generations in the same room together, because we know that, like, history comes alive and feels relevant when it's pulled from the past into the future, when we're gleaning from what happened before that can bring us into the next iteration of where we're going. So I think that feels like a really big piece for us. Trying to think of other kinds of impacts.
Those who don't remember their history are doomed to repeat it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we know that history is cyclical. It's not linear. And so we often go in these cycles. And I think one of the biggest themes that came out from the Pride Storytelling Project is this idea of the sort of cycle of fight and celebration. So it's like injustice happens, we're going to fight to get our rights, we're going to celebrate, and then here's the next one, you know? And just like in times like we're in right now, to sort of normalize that for people, like, oh man, there's like so many like bad things happening in the world, you know, or in our nation in particular, around people's rights and liberties.
People are tired. Yeah. People are tired of having to go through these patterns again, and are hoping that maybe this time we can escape that cycle and do something different.
Yeah, I think there's that for sure. And there's also like a lot of wisdom from people who've been through those cycles to say, like, this is what I do to feel resilient. This is what I do for hope. This is what I do to like take care of my neighbor, you know, when these are things
get
are happening.
The important takeaways. This is what worked in the past. Maybe that will work now. Well, these things didn't work, but, you know, so maybe we need to try something else this time, you know, and look at that past landscape and compare it to where we are now. There's a lot of validity for that.
Yeah. So I think that's a big piece, is sort of learning from the past and moving into the future. And then there's always a sort of community building aspect of our work. I mean, we get people together. Our work's often about, like, you know, communal listening to a story and then reflecting. And you'll see, like, a story is told, you know, we might share a story from our project and then it'll spark a memory from somebody else and they'll share something. And it's like this, that's where the memory activism, that title, comes into play. It's like, we're activating people's memory. We're like remembering in new and different ways. We're uplifting those stories that we don't often get to hear collectively in public. Maybe they're more private stories. So all of those things feel really, really important and help us feel rooted in this place, connected to each other. It helps to sort of stave off isolation and makes us feel like we matter, you know, all of us matter. So, yeah.
For sure.
Window Seat, just to be transparent, is actually really struggling financially right now, like a lot of nonprofits. We're trying to shift away from grant funding, relying so heavily on grant funding, as we've done for the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, to more community-based support. But the process of doing the transition from grants to community-based fundraising isn't really keeping up with itself, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're just sort of barely staying afloat financially. So that's another thing that people need to know, that, you know.
That's an important thing to share.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You hear that, everybody, all of my listeners. Let's give Elaine some love here with Window Seat Media.
So just to give you a sense, the last two budget years, I think 50% of our budget came from grants that were not renewable. And so we're trying to catch up with that with community-based funding. And during COVID times, there was a lot of money that was dispersed to nonprofits to help them weather that storm. And I think nonprofits took advantage of that, but then also, like, well, it's not renewable, you know? So we're trying to kind of catch up with community-based fundraising. So that's a big piece that we could always use help with. You know, whether you want to host a fundraising dinner at your house, we've been doing that and that's been really fun. Just making a donation online, you know, donations of time and resources are really welcome as well. So if there's like a particular skill set that people have that would like to donate their time towards that, that's always welcome.
Simply participating mm-hmm. keeps it moving, keeps it going.
Yes.
Fuels mm-hmm. the projects.
Exactly. I mean, I think it comes back to our mission of just really wanting to build capacity within our community to document and share its own stories. I mean, that's our mission, essentially, is for people to have the tools and the resources to document their own history and then share it. And so that we have, because we know that the archive has huge gaps in it, you know, we know our history books are written from what's in an archive. And so if there's big gaps, if there's like communities that are left out of our archive, they're not necessarily written into the history, right? And there's so many different people who live in our country, you know, in our communities, so many different people, so many different stories. And I think that we really lack a lot of, we have some like historical organizations in town, like the Bigelow House has been here forever, the Olympia Historical Society, you know, there's some places in Tumwater. But, you know, the city of Lacey has a museum. The folks working there are really wonderful. But I think that, you know, growing the, I don't know how else to say it, like the history or heritage sector, I think, in our community, and for Window Seat to play a role in that, and our role really being a community-based, community-led mm-hmm. History-making role would be amazing to me, where you could see, like, the archive just growing and the ways that people engage and share those stories grow. And the way that we think about history being really generative and dynamic and exciting. I think that would be exciting. We've also talked about curriculum. So last year was the first year we did a summer institute for educators, where we taught educators how to, use oral history, interviewing, and documentation skills in their classrooms. And one of the, there's a team of, I think, three educators from Reeves Middle School, and they wound up doing their own oral history project with their eighth graders. And that was really exciting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so also thinking about, like, how can our work be utilized by local educators so that the stories that we document can become a part of local curriculum feels like an exciting prospect to us. Like, actually those stories be used as texts, because we think about, you know, the people in our community as knowledge holders. And they have a lot of wisdom to share. People, you know, sharing wisdom just from the things that they've lived through feels really important. And so I think, like, knowing that those stories are accessible for people to learn from, students to learn from, feels important. So there's an archival piece, there's an educational curriculum piece that feels exciting. Being fully resourced to do, like, to run cohorts in a really effective way, that's intentional, where the cohort members really get training, they get financial resources. So we've, you know, we pay our, you got some, a stipend, a small mm-hmm. one, but each year we try and increase the stipend so that cohort members are actually getting paid for their time and their effort. So, you know, I guess those would be a few about the archive, about the education and curriculum, about the, just a really well-resourced cohort. So I think those are some of them. Mm-hmm. Another thing on our agenda really is to, you know, we have almost 10 years now of archival materials that feel like they need a more permanent home. But unfortunately in our community, we don't really have a repository, like an archive. We have the library, and they've been wonderful partners to us, and we're excited to get publications of our stories in the library, but it's not an archive. Evergreen has an archive, but I think is in some ways is sort of, I think, mission driven by Evergreen. So to the extent that our stories make sense there, I'm not sure. And then the Washington State Archive is really for government documents mainly. So I think one of the things is, like, what do we do with these materials so that they're accessible, like, to the public long term, and not just the short stories, but like the full length archive of materials, like all the long form oral history interviews. So I think that's a question in my mind. Like, what can we do? Like, how can we get all that organized? Like, that would be amazing to have that organized and put someplace. So I think that's a big piece, is like the archive. And I mean, I guess for me, it's like the permanency of an archive where you, I mean, to me, like, what's interesting about archival materials is they can come out at any time and you can make sense of them at any moment. Like 50 years from now, you can make sense of something that was recorded today. We can make sense of something that was recorded. You know what I mean? Like, so they're not like static. It isn't static materials, but you're like re-engaging with them. That's what makes history exciting, is if you're re-engaging with them in the present. So I think the archive feels like a piece.
Now, I wanted to ask you, do you partner with other organizations? You've mentioned mm-hmm. The word partner has come up.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Window Seat is very much of a community-driven, partnership-based organization. We always have been. So all of our projects have been partnerships, I think, essentially. Our most recent, this Pride Storytelling Project is a partnership with Capital City Pride. And the need and interest in that really came from that organization anyway. I mean, they're the ones who said, we're not finding this research in the library, you know, and came to Meg and said, Meg, you know, I hear you do this stuff at Window Seat. What can we do together, you know? So I think we like to be responsive to community needs. We did the Olympia Music History Project. That was a couple of years ago. And that was an idea of one of the heritage commissioners who said, you know, we've got this great history here in town. You know, Olympia music history is internationally known as like a place where amazing things happened. I mean, still happen, but I think particularly that moment in the 80s and 90s in Olympia. And so like people plant a seed, and then, you know, we responded, and I partnered with a librarian in town, Kelsey Smith, and she did more of the archival research, library-based research, and I facilitated the oral history collection. So working with a team of 8 or 9 musicians who did all the interviews, and they did like 30 some odd interviews over the course of like 3 or 4 months. It was pretty incredible. So then that organization, that group sort of spun off and created their own nonprofit now, you know, because of that sort of beginning seed that was planted. So it's really exciting to see them like off and running and using those skills that we kind of helped share with them early on. And they have a beautiful website now, and a lot of those interviews are now, you know, just accessible to the public. And one of the things that's exciting about that project is Olympia music has been covered, you know, over the years by various people. But I think that this project is unique in that it's like by Olympia for Olympia, kind of. So I think a lot of people have come in and wanted to like interview various people, but I think the fact that the people who were doing the interviews were local residents themselves kind of had it, just adds a different flavor to it. So that was a partnership. I'm trying to think of the other ones. I mean, our partnership for the Third 30 was Senior Services. And I think what's exciting is, you know, with Senior Services, that was early on. It was the Senior Services project was like the first time I tried out this community-based model where I was like teaching people to do the interviews themselves. And so I hadn't even tried it yet in the community. And I went to them, Sarah, who was the Rucker Thiessen, who was the lifelong learning person at the time. And I just pitched this idea, let's try it, you know. So I think one of the things that I love about Olympia is like those opportunities where you put an idea out there and then somebody says yes and you don't know where it's going to go. But I think like I feel really grateful for those moments where, you know, I've suggested like, what do you think about this? And somebody has said yes and we tried it. And, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But it's always exciting when people are up for something new.
Mm-hmm. It's always an experiment.
It is.
Resource Report was an experiment.
Yeah,
look where we are. Mm-hmm. You're like number 14.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, and speaking of the different episodes, you mentioned Olympia History Project, mm-hmm. name dropped Kelsey Smith, mm-hmm. and all of that Olympia History Project thing and your partnership with Window Seat Media was, in fact, that was something that was brought up when I interviewed Markley Morrison.
Oh, nice.
In our ninth. Yeah.
Excellent.
So it's really cool to have that cycle back mm-hmm. around and be brought up again. It's so cool, coming full circle. involved in a cohort project?
Each cohort has a slightly different, has had a slightly different format depending on the project. Mm-hmm. The current cohort, the prize storytelling cohort, is a 2-year project. And so year one was documentation, year two is public programming. It runs from about October to June. And the idea is that cohort members meet once a month. So I meet with them once a month. And our meetings are 2.5 hours long. And during that time, they learn the skills that they need to, like for the year one documentation, we looked at, you know, we learned oral history interviewing skills. We talked a lot about storytelling ethics, transcription, recording, like thinking about, you know, the technical aspects of doing a good recording. And then there was a lot of outreach too, just that folks did in terms of thinking about, you know, who do we want to interview? And early on, we did a lot of thinking about project design. You know, what is it that you want to focus on? What kinds of essential questions are we going to explore together as a group? And then, you know, how do we take these overarching essential questions and then each come up with their own interview questions based on who we're interviewing? So we sort of went through that whole process. And then next year, we'll do the public programming. And this year, we're actually hoping, if all the funding comes through, each cohort member, they'll be able to propose, like, this is the project that I want to do. And we'll be able to give cohort members a certain amount of money to do each of their projects so that they can create a little budget. You know, I know that I'm going to do an exhibit and printing is going to cost this much and I want to pay myself X amount, you know. So we're hoping that part of this is like the professional development skills. So, you know, we're supporting folks in learning how to propose like a project and thinking about the budget, what that budget would look like. And, you know, if you're doing an event, like what venue are you going to use? And can you get that as an in-kind donation? And, you know, all those kinds of things. So
that sounds like grant writing skills.
It is. Yeah, there's some grant writing skills in there for sure. Specifically around podcasting. And at this point, I think all of our cohort members are going to continue, as far as I know. But we will have space for probably one or two more people. And I think the things that we're particularly excited about is people who want to work on the podcast. So that would be a way to plug in. And if people are interested, just kind of signing up for our newsletter, and we'll probably hear about applying to be a cohort member in the next, I would say, month. Mm-hmm.
Where do people meet?
So right now we're housed at Arbutus Folk School. We've been here for about a year. We love it. We love being here. It's so wonderful to be in a space where people are creating art all the time and craft, engaged deeply in a craft. It's really exciting. And it also feels really good to offset the folk school's rent with our rent. So that feels great. And we've also really valued the partnership we've had with the YWCA, and particularly the Liberation Collective. So the Liberation Collective is a space that's housed at the YWCA in their Friendship Hall, but it's its own entity. And they provide space for groups who are needing space for workshops and different things. So that's where our cohort meetings currently happen.
So people who want to come and work with you in the cohorts, do people need to come in with already having some skills or experience working with media or interviewing or anything like that?
I would say no. I mean, I think I don't have an expectation that people will have skills already. I do have an expectation that people are open to learning and wanting to try new technologies and have some comfort level with trying new technologies. I think if you're somebody who like really doesn't like the computer or doesn't like to work with software, that maybe audio editing is probably not your thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I don't expect you to know how to do audio editing beforehand if that's the thing that you're going to be working on. I think the main thing that I hope from folks is, just an openness to learning this practice of oral history, which is different. It's a different approach to interviews than a lot of journalism is, or even like we produce so much content now for social media where people are being interviewed and then you create your short little thing and it's like under 2 minutes or whatever. This is not that. And so I think it's like, it's not content creation. We're not doing content creation, you know, we're doing oral history interviews that become content for public programming or podcasts or whatever. So I think it's shifting that frame in people's minds. So I think if you're open to like this other way of doing interviews, and grounding that, like the interview itself and this idea of the importance of the archive and the importance of the interview process, which is like a one-on-one conversation over an extended period of time. It's not 15 minutes. It's usually an hour or 90 minutes, you know? So if you're interested in that idea, then I welcome people, even if they have no experience. Yeah.
Cool. What if you happen to have somebody that comes in with like a lot of experience and skills?
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that too. So a good example of that was the music project. So with the Olympia Music History Project, I hosted, I think it was like a 4-hour training on a weekend. And that was it. So like so many people in that room already had a lot of experience. So instead of like meeting every week to like go through the process, we had this sort of like intensive, let's learn all the things together and share. So it was also like there was a lot of skill sharing during that training where people shared their own experience and tools and techniques in interviewing. So it felt much more like an exchange. And then once we had that, people were just sort of off and we did a lot of like checking in and, you know, there was a lot of communication back and forth with the different interviewers, but it didn't feel like a weekly class necessarily. Mm-hmm. And it was great. I mean,
does it cost anything to participate?
Most of our programs are free. Mm-hmm. So most of our events are free. When we do workshops like our Summer Institute, which we're doing again this year. So at the end of August, we have another Summer Institute. Those are typically for, you know, you have to pay to be a part of those workshops. But the nice thing is if you're an educator, so we're a clock hour provider. So if you're an educator, you can get your clock hours from participating. And often the educators also have opportunities where they can get a grant to take the program. So if you go on our website, I think it's called like a WEA grant or something like that. But if you go on our website, it'll say what the grant is.
Mm-hmm. How much does it cost to participate in those particular programs?
You know, we always do a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. So we like to have like one price point that's, you know, if cost is prohibitive, like here's what you pay, this is the actual cost. And then if you can pay above that, it helps to support the people who can't pay the actual cost.
I'll pay it forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, we usually do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like each different round of the program that you're in with a different group of people, there's a lot of room for flexibility and adaptability to that. It sounds almost like here's the plan, here's the project, and then let's see how that's going to play out and how we can work with these different people and their individual skills and needs that they bring and make this work. So you have a very low barrier entry for community members coming in to work with you. Like literally it could be anybody. I mean, this is a crazy wild example, but like what if you had like a government administrator wanting to do this in their off time? Or what if you had a really driven houseless individual, for example?
Yeah.
I mean, those are two major extremes.
Yeah, I mean, I think we maybe unconsciously have, I mean, now that you're talking about it like that, I'm realizing, yeah, like we don't really have a lot of requirements for people to participate. And I guess, like I was saying before, it's more of just an openness to learning and a commitment to the field, because I think that's the big piece, is that it's not Elaine coming up with this framework or these ethical guidelines. It's not me. It's a field that I'm connected to and that I was trained in. And so I think it's like we need to be, and not that we don't want to question, because, I mean, things change because we question them, right? So It's important if we notice something within the field that we're like, hey, that doesn't sound right, that we question it and we think about it. But mm-hmm. that this work belongs to a different field, to a larger field of practice, and that there's groups all over the U.S. doing this work. Amazing groups, you know, even here in the Northwest, Wanawari up in Seattle is an amazing organization in the Central District, and they're doing lots of things, but one of the pieces that they do is called the Black Spatial Histories Institute. I hope I'm saying that right. And they do a similar cohort model. It's a 2-year process where they have folks doing oral history interviewing and they're doing public programming. So we have them to the north. Certainly the Wing Luke Museum is an amazing example of a community curated museum that really is deeply embedded in oral history practices. The Vanport Mosaic to the south in Portland, similar group. The After Violence Project, which is started out in Texas but now is kind of all over the place, really documenting the experience of individuals and families who've been impacted by state violence and incarceration, doing really, really important work. But there's examples all over, you know. So we're part, I think of us as a part of this larger field. That's an underrepresented field, but we're there. We exist.
What if you were to work with the... What's it called? It's a program at Evergreen working with the incarcerated students.
Oh, Kent. Yeah, Gateways for Incarcerated Youth.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. you know, maybe help I think get their stories out and learn skills learning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. I mean, I think there's this level to this layer around, like, trauma-informed interviewing and practices that feels like I feel like our work is trauma-informed, but I think we have some work to do around working with particular populations that are maybe more vulnerable in that respect. Because there's a lot of ways that interviewing can, like, cause harm to people, like, can re-trigger trauma, you know, depending on what kinds of questions that you ask. And if you're somebody who hasn't experienced something, like this has come up a lot with like interviewing with houseless folks, for example. If you're somebody who hasn't gone through that and then you do an interview with somebody who has, you could ask, like unintentionally ask a question that could be really painful to that person or re-traumatize them. And so I think there's a piece around that too where it feels important. And I think that's part of our
ethical storytelling. I was mm-hmm. going to say it circles back to that.
And also just our framework where our projects, we try to have our projects be done by people who are directly a part of the community that they're documenting. So like all of our, with our Pride storytelling project, I mean, all of our cohort members doing the interviews identify as part of the LGBTQ community. And so that feels important because there's a level of like understanding more, I think, of like, of just what
giving agency mm-hmm. to their stories and right. their voices.
Exactly.
For sure.
Yeah, so I think there's that piece for sure.
Yeah, this is an amazing community resource that you have, Elaine.
Thank you.
Know, working with supporting people and sharing their own stories mm-hmm. and looking at how their stories fit in with the greater story, collective story of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you would like to share?
Well, I think the only thing else I'd want to share is that it really feels like, all of our work has been a collective effort. Like, I think about all the people along the way who've said yes to different things, who've been on our board and been incredible advisors, or, you know, creative collaborators. I've collaborated with so many talented people who've, you know, done artwork for exhibits or produced, like, original music for the podcasts, you know, created, like, this group of dancers who created this whole dance performance for our Inhale Exhale project. It's just exciting to have opportunities to put out an invitation and say, you know, what do you think? And have people join and add their own creative flair to whatever we're doing and get some fulfillment of whatever goal that they might have. So working collectively feels really important and exciting to me. And I hope that that's always at the center of our work. Because I think, you know, Window Seat and our projects in general really center on this idea of collectivism as opposed to individualism. So our oral history projects in general are hoping to, you know, uplift this idea of collective organizing, working together, and that we're all part of an ecosystem, you know, and that all of our roles matter, that, you know, everybody has a role to play in social change. All of those roles are important and needed, and they're all interdependent. There's no person that's any more important than the next person, you know, and just really leveraging that. So I think in our own work, we try and emulate that as well in the way that we organize our projects. So I would say that that's a big piece. And I should also say, that our overarching project or theme of all of our work is Community Roots. And Community Roots is a project that really explores how people come together to make change and create new possibilities for themselves and their neighbors. And it really focuses on organizing efforts and artists often intersecting with each other. So we know in our community that community arts and community organizing are very aligned with each other and intersecting. And so Community Roots serves as sort of our overarching project, and all the things that we've done sort of underneath that speak to that bigger theme and bigger project. So we have this bigger theme, and then we might focus on a particular topic or community. Like the Pride Storytelling Project, LGBTQ community, Inhale, Exhale is really around how are we taking care of each other in this, you know, non-conventional way at the time, end of life. Third Spaces, which was our original Community Roots project, you know, is thinking about access to space, who has access to space, and the importance of space in relationship to community organizing and making art together. It's a community. So all of our projects kind of fit under that overarching theme of community roots and organizing and art making, I guess.
So Community Roots is like the umbrella project for all these smaller sub-projects.
Yes, I would say so.
What's the best way to reach out?
Yeah, so I would suggest we send out a monthly newsletter that has all the details of everything. So signing up for our newsletter on our website is a great way to stay in touch. We're also on Facebook and on Instagram. So that's another place where we're posting updates and just different things for people to be aware of. Those are the three best ways, I would suggest.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah, pretty simple.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. It was fun to be here.
It was amazing for me to have Elaine on Resource Report because I actually interned with her. To have your own experience working with Elaine, visit www.windowseatmedia.org, and you can shoot Elaine an email at elaine@windowseatmedia.org or call 360-754-6506. Don't forget to sign up for that newsletter. That That's it for today's resource report, produced by Pathways to Agency. At Pathways to Agency, we are driven by the belief that everyone should have the tools and support to achieve their goals and thrive in their communities. Our mission is to bridge the gaps in understanding, accessibility, and trust by connecting individuals to resources and sharing information and processes that can lead to personal and community growth. Resource Report offers information about existing and emerging nonprofits and resource organizations. Find out more at pathwaystoagency.org. You can also find our shows archived indefinitely on rss.com/podcasts/resource-report. Chaos Radio is not responsible or liable for any views or opinions expressed in the interviews conducted by Resource Report. Till next time, and thanks for listening.